PR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Severance Reed Architects, Designers, and Planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for higher education, lifestyle, and cultural clients, on the web at www.ratioarchitects.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today. On the program, we're going to take a look at the growing phenomenon of social entrepreneurship. Journalist David Bornstein is our guest in this portion of the program today. He says social entrepreneurs question the status quo, exploit new opportunities, refuse to give up, and remake the world for the better. Bornstein says this is a big story that has been underreported. He says we've all heard about the explosion of dot-coms, but we haven't heard about the explosion of dot-orgs. In his new book, How to Change the World, Bornstein notes that during the 1990s, the number of registered international citizen organizations in the Yearbook of International Organizations increased from 6,000 to 26,000. This afternoon, we'll talk about the reasons for this growth. We'll also look at the problems being tackled by social entrepreneurs and get a sense of how they're tackling those problems. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, David Bornstein. Join us with a telephone call. The telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. David Bornstein specializes in writing about social innovation. In addition to How to Change the World, he is the author of The Price of a Dream, the story of the Grameen Bank. He has also written articles for The Atlantic Monthly and The New York Times. His new book, How to Change the World, Social Entrepreneurs and the Power of New Ideas, is published by Oxford University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to join the discussion. David Bornstein, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you, Celeste. It's a pleasure.
Would you give us some idea here at the top, some sense of the kinds of things social entrepreneurs are doing to try to change the world?
Sure. I'll give a couple of examples. One of the most famous social entrepreneurs in the world is a man named Muhammad Yunus, who founded an organization called the Grameen Bank, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. The Grameen Bank pioneered an idea of making small loans to women villagers in the late 70s as a way to help combat poverty. And this idea, which became known as microcredit, spread initially to a few hundred and then a few thousand villagers. Today, the Grameen Bank provides loans to more than 2.5 million women villagers. And the idea of microcredit, largely through the marketing efforts, you could say, or the spreading efforts of Muhammad Yunus, has is now being implemented by more than 3,000 organizations around the world. And more than 50 million families around the world get microcredit loans. So this is truly a global change. That's just one example.
Yeah.
Some of the other examples that I talk about in my book are, for example, a woman, a man in the United States named J.B. Schramm, originally from Denver, actually does a lot of work of his work in Chicago now, has created an organization called College Summit. And what this does is it gets low-income high school students into college at a much higher rate than they would normally enroll. As a matter of fact, their enrollment rate is close to 80% versus 46%, which is the national average. So what they've worked with several thousand students. So they're developing a more efficient college access system. In other parts of the world, you have social entrepreneurs creating child protection systems for street kids, systems to distribute solar energy, to actually rent solar energy to poor villagers, so that they can have better futures in the countryside, better living and working opportunities for people with disabilities. You have lots of social entrepreneurs working in the field of disability. Education is a huge opportunity, you know, improving public schools, improving daycare systems. And now one of the sort of new fields for social entrepreneurship, particularly in the United States, is to create new organizations that allow people who are in their 50s and 60s who have, you know, 30 more years to live or 35 more years to live or whatever, and they don't really look forward to playing golf for the next 30 years, to create organizations that really allow them to tap into their desire to make a contribution to society. There's really not enough organizations that make that happen for the huge sort of baby boomers who are going to be starting to turn 60 in 2006.
Yeah.
So it's really an enormous spectrum of ideas. Basically, if you can imagine what entrepreneurs do in the business sector, which is come up with new business ideas, new products that society needs, what you have in the social arena, social entrepreneurs come up with the same sorts of things, new ideas, new services and products that society needs. But the main goal here is to create social value. So you could call it social profit or social change versus primarily economic gain.
Hmm. As you point out in How to Change the World, people who do good acts have been around for a very long time. Are the people today who are engaged in social entrepreneurship different from their predecessors?
No, not at all. What's different in the world today is not the temperament or the motivation of the social entrepreneur. It's that there are so many people around the world who first of all, have the capacity to become social entrepreneurs. For example, in the United States, we have a very rich tradition of social entrepreneurship. We can think of people like Harriet Tubman or Susan B. Anthony, very, very important people in the history of the United States, many movements, abolitionism, for example, the March on Washington. Martin Luther King is famous for having made his I Have a Dream speech there. But if you look back on how the March on Washington came about, there was a great social entrepreneur named Asa Philip Randolph, who was very, very important in creating a black labor movement in the United States. It was his vision to create the March on Washington, and he actually was the person who brought together many of the people to make that happen. Very entrepreneurial when you think of how you actually get things done, meaning that you have to build teams, you have to pull together resources, and you have to have a strategy that will actually achieve a change. The motivation of social entrepreneurs is not primarily altruistic, just like the motivation of entrepreneurs is not primarily greed. What you have is enormous capacity, people around the world who love to build things. You may hear my 14-month-old in the
back.
Yeah. I'm a 50% dad. So people love to build things. It's probably the most basic human desire. And what we have now is many, many people who have entrepreneurial abilities, who love to build things, are seeing that there's a real urgency. There's a lot of social problems that need to be addressed in new ways. We need new models. We need creativity. It's also more feasible to have a career doing this because people in the social arena now are looking for a kind of inventiveness that, you know, over the last 20 or 30 years, they weren't necessarily looking for. There was more of a sense that the government is going to solve all our problems. People now say, okay, maybe we do need creative citizens to develop these new models, which can then be scaled up with the help of government, but maybe it's not the government that is the lead actor. Maybe it's actually, just like creative entrepreneurs build our most creative businesses, ideas that nobody really would have come up with sitting in a government agency. The same thing in the social arena. And what I've seen over and over again in my own research are ideas that nobody could have ever thought of. You know, really, these are ideas like this college access model, College Summit, and the Grameen Bank, microcredit. These are ideas that people worked on for 10 or 15 years until they really got them to the point where they were scalable, where they worked out all the kinks. That is classic entrepreneurial behavior, you know, sitting in the garage working on your computer until you finally got it working. In business, they call it the skunk works, the place where people sit in the basement and try to figure out the product that will be launching 5 years from now. Well, I think I think the social entrepreneurs are like the R&D arm of society. And more you see the terrific ideas out there that really do transform society. We can even think of Alcoholics Anonymous in the United States, a perfect example of a system for solving a problem that emerged out of the efforts of individual entrepreneurs.
Yeah. When you say, you know, not primarily altruistic, immediately came to mind a guy by the name of Bill Drayton. He just seems to be hardwired to be an entrepreneur, although altruism is part of this. He wants to do good things. He went to work for the EPA some time ago, and he left the agency following the election of Ronald Reagan. And he told you, "I don't like conflict. Fighting to defend something doesn't turn me on. I like to build things."
That's right. He's a perfect example of Bill could have made a ton of money if he went into the private sector. I mean, he was in the private sector. He worked for McKinsey & Company for 9 years, and he was a very, very successful management consultant. I mean, he could have just risen to very high heights in that field. But his goal was to maximize the social impact of his life, I guess you could say. We can think of an entrepreneur who wants to build the world's largest running shoe company, or you can also think of an entrepreneur who wants to vaccinate the world's children. Those are very different motivations.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, the temperament and the skills that allow those two things to happen are actually pretty similar. So we have to get to the question, why? What's different between these people? And ultimately, as you can see, if you look at Bill Drayton's history, or the history of many social entrepreneurs, they often have a very, very, very strong childhood influences. People who, I guess you could say, they internalize their ethical ideas at a very young age, and don't feel that unless, you know, if they're not working on these issues that have a deep sort of ethical fiber, they don't really feel like they're living their life in the way that seems beautiful to them and seems right to them. And so when I say that people aren't altruistic, I don't mean that they're not doing good things and they don't care about other people. What I mean is that there's a tendency to feel that if you're a social entrepreneur or you're altruistic, that you're selfless or you're sacrificing. The social entrepreneurs I've met, Bill Drayton is probably the best example of it, are very, very happy people. I mean, they never want to retire. I mean, it's not Monday to Friday, thank God it's Friday, now I can go have fun. These are people who really, really are working on things that turn them on at a very deep level. And I would say that they're self-more in that sense, that they're very deeply listening to the things inside them that they really want to do and they really care about. So they find a way to align their talents, their interests, in a way that they can have impact and make a contribution to the world.
Mm.
It's very exciting. And it's also why so many people want to join them. You know, Bill Drayton has had thousands of people over the years want to help him build up the organization Ashoka, which I write about in my
mm-hmm.
book, that supports social entrepreneurs in 50 countries now. He's been building this for 25 years, and he's got thousands of people who have contributed money, time, pro bono help, expertise, who've worked for the organization, who've agreed to be nominators and people sitting on panels to help select social entrepreneurs. And all of this is because they love the idea of being associated with something that is so powerful and so exciting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there is an organization of students here at the University of Illinois of Indian ancestry, and they hold fundraising events for Ashoka projects in India. Maybe you would tell us a little bit about the organization and what it's doing, and then how was it that, you know, Bill Drayton, how did he go about building the organization so that an organization of students at the University of Illinois would be involved? He had to get the word out. He had to, as you point out in the book, if you're going to be a social entrepreneur, you've got to be a producer and a promoter.
That's right. The background of Ashoka is that, well, just to tell you generally speaking, Ashoka is named after an Indian emperor, Ashoka, who lived about 2,200 or 2,300 years ago. He's a very enlightened man in world history, one of the great emperors in world history. He created what might be thought of as the first ever class of public servants dedicated to social welfare. And this was, you know, before Christ. Bill, obviously, who's a lover of history, thought that Ashoka was a great historical model to name the organization after. What Ashoka does is it supports and it looks for social entrepreneurs, budding social entrepreneurs, people at an early stage in their career around the world who need the support of a network, who need initially some financial support, and then they need to be working with colleagues so that they can exchange ideas and work at a much higher level. And so Ashoka has now supported more than 1,400 social entrepreneurs in 50 countries around the world. And it's created this global network of social entrepreneurs who really collectively represent one of the most important, I would say, forces on the planet. How did build up this organization? And it's interesting. What I've learned through my study of social entrepreneurship is that there's a kind of power in the world that is very poorly characterized and almost never discussed in public. When we think of Martin Luther King and the power of a man like Martin Luther King, we immediately think of the power of somebody who can address 100,000 people at once and sort of give them all a chill down their spine. But Bill's power is the ability to have 100,000 conversations in sequence over a 30 or 40-year period, you know, 8 of them a day, let's say, or 10 of them a day, each one of them where you've really had a deep impact on the person on the other side of the table, convince them that their life can be more exciting by being involved in your idea in some way, and then having follow-up steps. And I suspect this is what happened with the students that you were referring to who created the organization to support Ashoka Fellows in India. Probably, you know, along the line there was a meeting, they got together, they got very excited, and they said, we really want to do something in India, but we want to make sure that what we're doing is having a real impact. We don't just want to throw away some money without really knowing. And I think, you know, the idea of supporting a social entrepreneurs in India probably appealed to people as being one that was very compelling. And it probably happened because they got to meet Bill or another person in Ashoka who spread that idea, who persuaded them. I actually write about two Ashoka Fellows in India in my book. One of them is, just to give an example, is a woman named Jeru Bilimoria. Originally, she's from Bombay. And she created a child protection system for street children. It began in Bombay in 1996 using a traditional call model where the calls would come in through a toll-free number. And actually, street children would man the phones and would actually go out and rescue other street youth. Jeru didn't have enough money to hire paramedics, so she trained the street youth to do this. This very low-cost child protection system has, in the last 8 years, spread to 55 cities in India. It's fielded more than 5 million calls. It's rescued more than 100,000 street children. And it's actually since been adopted by the Indian government as the national system. Now, all of this was built up just over the last 8 years. And what's interesting is that Ashoka was supporting Jeru Bilimoria. They, after she had spread to just a few cities, she said that Ashoka went and said, this person is a tremendous entrepreneur. They're really going to make a national impact with this model, and we want to get them in our fellowship and help them and give them legitimacy and also help get their ideas to other people around the world that can learn from the way she's having impact. So if I were someone who wanted to support social change in India, I would think be very confident about making a grant or an investment in Childline, which is Jeru's organization, because I know that they're really having tremendous impact.
Yeah. She told you that the first year she was trying to get this organized, all mistakes. The first year was all about mistakes, she said. And one of the things about these social entrepreneurs, like any entrepreneur, tenacity is key, one of the keys. You got to keep at it. How does somebody like Jeru Bilimoria keep on task? You know, and some of these people that you profile in the book have been working on problems for decades, like the man who is working in Brazil for rural electrification.
That's right. That's one of the deep mysteries. The tenacity, the motivation, the durable motivation. I tend to think that's why, once again, it is linked to something that is formed in people's character at a very young age. You know, Ray Kroc was running, started McDonald's in his 50s, but he was still running it in his 80s. If he were still alive today, he would still probably be running McDonald's and trying to make it better. You know, people who build things in the world have that kind of motivation. They decide that that's what their life is about. In the case of Giroux, she had spent many years working, in a way, apprenticing herself to start this organization called Childline. And what I mean by apprenticing herself is, if you look at the previous 10 or 20 years, you can find all sorts of experiences that lead up to the decision where she finally launches this organization. She had launched a couple of earlier organizations trying to do similar things that weren't nearly as successful. She had studied nonprofit management. She had lived in New York City and worked with the Coalition for the Homeless. So it's almost like watching a homing pigeon, you know, hone in on the target, so to speak. When she finally gets to the point where she launches the organization, I think there's a very strong identification with the idea, meaning that the idea and herself become one, in a sense. And so she's building an idea of what the world should look like. She's working in a very, very, very connected way with who she is as a person. The first year, as you mentioned, Childline was all about problems. I mean, millions of problems had to be solved. And this is very much what differentiates the effective social entrepreneur from other social actors. You know, it's a lot of people would have quit, you know, perhaps after the first year, or they would have turned up their hands and they might have said, we can't run a hotline with street youth running it. Nobody listens to them. The police give us hassles. Nobody at the hospitals will talk to the street youth when they come in with a sick child. And in each case, every one of these problems was solved. And what I find fascinating when I think of what Giroux did is she began with a presumption that if people aren't cooperating, if they're not helping one another, it's not because they're bad people or because our society is useless. It's because there's some sort of understanding that they don't have, that I have. And so my job is to get that understanding to them. And so she would work with the police and she would work with the hospital people. And in not that much time, they came around and suddenly they became her allies. The police were actually helping the Childline team members. And that was something that I found very remarkable. So I think what happens is you begin to solve a few problems in your first year. You overcome what look to be insurmountable obstacles, and you develop even more confidence in the workability of your idea, and that allows you to dream even bigger.
Hmm. And also you have to be capable of seeing progress as small as it is.
That's a very, very important point. Celebrating, you know, I remember when I asked Muhammad Yunus, who founded the Grameen Bank, which, as I mentioned, you know, is now serving millions of villagers, what his motivation was when he started. And he told me very clearly, he said, he was an economics professor at the time, he said, I was a little tired of the theory and sitting in the classroom in such a poor country. I felt that if I could just actually help one person, one woman in this village, then I would feel that my life had been worthwhile. And, you know, I've heard him utter that sentiment a number of times to know that it is true. And that's something very, very powerful, this idea that they're not only measuring success by huge impact. You know, they are able to really appreciate along the way the success that they have with few people. The same is with J.B. Schramm, who created College Summit, the college access program that works around the United States, including in Chicago. His first year, he was working as a teen counselor in a teen center in a low-income housing development in Washington, D.C. And he really troubled him that a lot of these very capable high school kids weren't going to go to college. And so one year he just worked with four of them. He helped them write their college essays and helped them get a little bit of counseling from college guidance counselors who he brought into the teen center. So those four students enrolled in college, and probably, certainly not all four would have gone. Maybe only two of them would have gone. So he worked with four, and the next year he worked with four more. And you know, even though he knew that the college access problem in the United States was much bigger than that, he was able to really get a lot of sort of charge in his batteries from helping these four students get into college. He still has relationships with these four students. So even now today that College Summit is working with thousands, he can revisit those students, and some of them, one of them even worked for College Summit for a number of years. So I think that's very important in helping people have, you know, the confidence, the emotional, I guess the emotional feedback, you can say, that will give them the strength to keep on working on things that are very hard and often come with a lot of external resistance.
Let's talk with a listener. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, David Bornstein. He's a journalist. His latest book, How to Change the World, Social Entrepreneurs and the Power of New Ideas. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest is familiar with Frances Moore LePay's work and her more recent book, Hope's Edge, The New Diet for a Small Planet?
I know of the book. I have to say that this has been a very busy year for me, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But I've actually emailed with Frances, and I am familiar with the work, and I do look forward to reading her book.
Well, I'm not sure if it was a review or a summary of that book or another essay that she had on a United Nations site, but it was written, I think, just around the time of September 11th, but I don't know if that was actually so relevant, but it seemed that she mentioned Han Yunus and his program of microinvestment, and also she was kind of reviewing development programs in various parts of the world. And her title, Hope's Edge, was kind of, you know, we have to be positive, we have to keep working, but there are some problems. And one of the problems she was pointing out, and I think she did mention something about this microinvestment program, that now that it's taken off, that women are actually being fairly marginalized in it, that they're not really getting into, you know, the managerial positions, or that there's some kind of bureaucracy or something that's been created. I'm just wondering, and generally I guess she was concerned about the fact that there are reasons for hope, but yet it just seems that women keep having trouble getting, you know, into positions of power, even when, you know, that the original program is to do that.
Oh, that's absolutely, absolutely correct. You know, the microcredit field has grown tremendously. As it has grown, there have been a lot of people who have tried to pull it in different directions. A lot of the new investment that goes into microcredit, believe it or not, comes from commercial banks.
Yes, and once something gets accepted, then it seems to get co-opted, or it seems to change into the form, the previous form, rather than the new form.
Well, that's the danger. The danger is that it will become another form of banking, and it will then come with the principles of banking. And the principles of banking are you try to have bigger loans, you try to lend to people who are more creditworthy, less risk, and so forth. And so ultimately, you're still maybe dealing with low-income people if it's microcredit, but you're not dealing with the poorer people. And the poorer people are always poorer women, it seems.
The poor of the poor, yes.
Right. So in microcredit, there's a very, very strong sort of pull now. The Grameen Bank has tried to keep the focus on the poorest of the poor. And Muhammad Yunus, as a matter of fact, they've just launched a program that actually targets specifically beggars, the very, very poorest people who are almost always poor women in villages in Bangladesh. These are literally are people who might sit under a tree and beg. They're actually trying to see if they can develop a very, very targeted small loan program where they could, one of the things that beggars have in Bangladesh is actually they're able to move around more freely than other women because they've sort of, the codes of purdah don't apply to them as stringently because of the fact that they've sort of dropped off the social status in some sense.
Cut off outside of family.
Right. And so they actually have more freedom to move around. So one of the ideas is that they can use this freedom to be peddlers and to actually sell, you know, trinkets and things like that in villages, but they need money to generate an inventory. Now, this is just a very new loan program, which the Grameen Bank, if you think about it, 25, almost 30 years after it was founded, is creating a new program still aimed at its original mission. Now, around the world, there's many organizations in microcredit, and some of them I think are moving away from the original mission of reaching the very, very poorest. They're trying to make it more financially sustainable and attract more investment. And some of them are more pure, and they're saying, no, we have governance structures in our organization that forces us to keep our focus on the very poor. And I think it's very important, and one of the roles of a social entrepreneur is to keep on returning to the original meaning of the idea, to make meaning so that other people don't lose sight of those. Another is to create new organizations that compete with older ones and actually are better than the older ones. So
yeah. Okay.
The field of microcredit needs to keep being reinvented because mm-hmm. some will want to be reinvented towards cost savings, and others will want to keep on reinvented, like the Grameen Bank is doing, to try to develop new products, new services that actually can reach the original clients.
But it seems like then the original clients are a little bit, you know, they're cut off in terms of gender and class and education. Therefore, it would be difficult for them to actually get into the organization and running of such programs.
You mean actually working for the Grameen Bank and working for these
organizations?
Yeah,
I guess so. Or like in having control or having input as to how they work. I mean, and I don't know that much about the Grameen Bank. I just remember this critique in general from Francis Moore-Lepay, which
it's a very valid critique. You know, even the Grameen Bank has a small percentage of its employees are actually women. A minority of its employees are women. There are organizations that have been a little more successful on that line, like BRAC in Bangladesh, which has a much higher percentage of its employees who are women. This is a very big struggle. A lot of it does have to do with the fact it's not only that women are undereducated. That's not necessarily the big problem. In the case of the Grameen Bank and many microcredit programs around the world, the job entails walking around a lot, meeting mm-hmm. people in villages, going from house to house. And in traditional societies like in Bangladesh or in India, the social mores make it difficult for women to accept those jobs because husbands and fathers and brothers would prefer that their women in their families are not taking jobs where they're out so much out in public.
It has to do with the gendering of space.
That's one of those incremental changes, problems that have to be dealt with incrementally, because you can develop real backlash if you try to change those things suddenly. Now, having said that, because of microcredit in Bangladesh, there's more women that vote in the elections now than men each year in the last two elections that they had. So this is quite a dramatic change, and it comes from the rising empowerment or consciousness that has come indirectly through all these microcredit programs. So it's, you can look at the negative, but you also can look at forces that show that there are positive changes too.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455 if you'd like to talk this afternoon with David Bornstein. Our topic today, social entrepreneurship. One of the things that the caller mentioned was in terms of Francis Moore-Lepay and I think there was a connection in terms of September 11th. She didn't know, the caller didn't know if LePay had written this book in response to that. But it raises this question in my mind. Can world events galvanize people? Can that help people to move ahead and to take action?
Oh, absolutely. I think September 11th was a transformative event in many people's minds. I just came up from a conference in Atlanta, for example, when I was speaking, and I met two folks who just launched a new magazine called Worthwhile, which is about people. They'd done a whole array of market research, and they found out that there was this whole class of people in business who wanted to combine their abilities in business with a desire to solve social problems and do things that are worthwhile. That's the title of the magazine, Worthwhile. So they'd done this market research, and they found that September 11, among the people that, who they interviewed, was almost always cited as something that affected people's understandings of the world. In my own research, I've seen that pan out as well. But one of the things that I'd like to say is that social entrepreneurship is a tremendous phenomenon, and it's not a fad. It's not like a couple of events have made this happen, but it's going to die out and people are going to go back to hand gliding next year. The forces that have allowed millions of people around the world to start new organizations and to improve existing organizations are deeply historical, and they have to do with things like the women's rights movements, which has spread slowly around the world over the last 30 years, the rights of minorities, Afro-Brazilians, blacks in South Africa, untouchables in India, groups that, if you go back even 10 or 15 years, had much, much less freedom in order to try to do things. Plus the spread of democracy, all those people who used to be banned in South Africa or used to be jailed in Brazil or Chile or in Hungary or Poland, former communist countries, can now do things that, even in countries like Indonesia and places where you have more sort of liberalism, even if you haven't really gotten to true democracy yet, you do have more constitutional liberalism. So people have more freedom, less fear, and then, of course, there's global media. And then finally, there's a real sense of urgency, a real growing consciousness that problems are getting quite serious, and we can't rely on the governments to solve them. And businesses, while they create wealth, they create a lot of problems as well that they are unwilling to address. And so there's this both a sense of there's three things. There's more opportunity for people. Forces have all created opportunities and freedoms. There's more consciousness, greater understanding of the threats that we're facing. And what was the third thing? Oh, no.
Well, I've got a listener waiting to talk with us, and I want to get to that caller. I want to say that to that caller. Hang in there for another moment here. But one of the things that I thought was interesting when you write about what the reasons are behind this phenomenon, one of them is, I'll quote, "While concerns have mounted about global problems, so has the conviction that governments are failing to solve them." I think that that's another reason. I don't know if that's the reason you had at the tip of your
tongue. That was the third one. Thank you.
At the tip of your tongue. But here's the question that I have. I think that's a really good observation. The question I had when I read that statement, I was wondering, well, do you think social entrepreneurship will change government, either spur it to greater accountability and transparency, or will government just take a further step backward, relinquish more responsibility?
I don't think the government should relinquish responsibility. I think it is the government's. The government is the only body in society that represents the whole of society. Social entrepreneurs, for all their merits, can do things that are very undemocratic. They can do things just because they want to do them. And if you're a successful social entrepreneur, you will amplify whatever you want to do, because that's the nature of entrepreneurship. It tends to make itself big in the world. And, if you're Ray Kroc and you like the colors red and yellow, the whole world will be painted red and yellow because that's what you like. And not everybody else will like it. So there's a problem with entrepreneurship. There's a basic problem with the idea that a person who has an outsized personality or power can have a much bigger effect on the world than other people. Okay? So government's role is to legitimize and to ultimately create, to hone in the social entrepreneurs, to regulate the sector to some degree, but also to scale it up, to look for the best ideas and say, okay, here's a system that's been developed, it's on the ground, it's working in six cities, it's getting kids into college at a much higher rate than the social structures that we now have. It'll never grow just with philanthropy. I mean, it can grow to a certain point with philanthropy, but it's not going to become a national organization. It will take 100 years with philanthropy to make it a national organization. You know, businesses that are successful can go national in 10 or 15 years, like Starbucks, you know, because there's a lot of investment in the private sector. The social entrepreneurs need, you know, similar levels of investment if they're going to take their solutions and really reach large numbers of people. And the only body in society that can do that routinely is the government. So the role of the government is to maintain the responsibility, but also to play a great facilitation role, to look for the best ideas out there and to use the tax revenues that it has and the legitimacy that it has to spread ideas. Now, it's the problem with government is that it tends to not be as good operationally, in many cases, as social entrepreneurs. And I'm not sure why this is, but almost all of the real innovative ideas that I've come across over the last 10 years doing research in this field have come from individual social actors. They haven't actually come out of government. And yet, when I look at Childline in India, Childline, which was developed by Jeru Billamoria and her team of students, a fantastic model for child protection, they never could have gone to scale if they didn't have a relationship with the government. The government hadn't adopted it as a national program. The same thing is with College Summit Now. They're working with the Chicago Public Schools in order to reach out to a much larger set of students in the city of Chicago than they could otherwise with the resources that they can raise from foundations and businesses. So what government is going to do, I think the role of government is going to become sharpened in the future. Its representational role is going to become much more clear, but its operational role is going to become more of a partnership, a strategic partnership with the social entrepreneurs.
Let's talk with that listener now. Caller in Champaign, line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if the guest today is familiar with an organization called Swadhyay Parivar or Swadhyay Family. I'll just hang up and listen.
Don't hang up yet because I don't know about that organization.
Maybe.
Can you describe it?
Yeah.
It started early 1950s, and I was familiar recently with this organization. So I was wondering if you have more information on how they work or how their social pattern is across all over the world now, if you are at all familiar with this organization.
Can you say the name again?
It's called Swadhyay, Swadhyaya.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first name, and it's called Parivar. That's basically a Sanskrit name for a family.
I don't know about it, but I would like to learn about it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We're here. We just have a little bit of time left in this portion of the program. Is there anything, I have another question, but maybe there's something that you would like to say that maybe we haven't yet hit upon in our discussion this afternoon that you would like to talk about?
Yeah, there's one point that I would really like to stress. When I talk about social entrepreneurship, I don't mean to imply that social change is all about triumphant individuals and the rest of us can sort of sit on the sidelines and wait for things to happen. What makes social entrepreneurs effective is their ability to build teams. They're like the chicken stock in the soup. Pull together a lot of ingredients. But every one of the people that I've interviewed over the last 10 years, and it's been quite a number of people, they're all successful because they build very, very good teams, hundreds of people getting together, working on problems together. If we think of entrepreneurship in the private sector, for every entrepreneur, there is, 50 or 100 or 1,000 people behind them who are doing all the work, running the organization, figuring out the computer systems, figuring out the management, mm-hmm. marketing, all that stuff. The rise of social entrepreneurship is essentially the rise of a whole new sector, a whole new set of opportunities for people across society. And this applies to everybody. It's not just whether you think you're a social entrepreneur or what you should be. Whatever you do, whatever skills you have, there are new organizations in society that exist, many of them probably just founded in the last 10 years, that are working on problems that need your skills. And they're out there in much larger numbers than they were in the past. And so for young people who are looking for different career opportunities, for older people who are perhaps looking for second career opportunities, more rewarding things to do in their semi-retirement or in their retirement, and so forth. There really are terrific opportunities and exciting opportunities for everyone. This is a whole new sector that's opening up.
Yeah.
People could look at the Ashoka website, ashoka.org, to get a sense of the kinds of things that Ashoka fellows in the United States are doing. There are, and Ashoka itself has a magazine called Changemakers, changemakers.net. you can find that there's a lot of new stuff going on out there. And I know from my own experience speaking to groups around the country that a lot of people really do hunger to do things, you know, different things in their life. They still need to make money. They still want to you know, they don't want to give up all of their other goals in life, but they would like to perhaps apply their skills in a slightly different way and feel that what they're doing is more meaningful. And what I've seen is that there are definitely opportunities for that.
Yeah. Help the entrepreneur get the project out of the garage.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting about social entrepreneurs is that they're so strong in some areas, and then they have complete blind spots in other areas. They like, for example, Jeru Billamoria passed on Childline to a much better administrator than she was, because she was, she told me, she says, I was a terrible administrator. J.B. Schramm brought in a guy who has helped him spread around the country, because he used to work on franchising for Pepsi, Pepsi-Cola, and he really understood, the whole way you set up multi-site franchises and how you handle the quality control and how you manage a growing organization. And
I got to stop you there.
Oh, sorry.
We're out of time. It's really been a pleasure talking with you, David. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Celeste.
David Bornstein has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of How to Change the World, Social Entrepreneurs, and the Power of New Ideas. The book is published by Oxford University Press. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the wheat pit finished the day higher. That's the third day in a row that the wheat pit has moved higher, although just a little higher. They were up close to the top end of the range today, but still just 2 cents higher in that December contract. And they filled some gaps that were left in September. Most of the traders in the board thinking that's a good deal technically. We'll talk with of AgriVicer Services. Almost forgot Dan Zwicker's last name here this afternoon. During the closing market report today, December futures now 315.5, the high, the low at 310.75, a settlement price at 314. And once again, that wheat finished the day 2 cents higher. March contract 325.75, the high, the low at 321.5, settlement price at 324.75. They were up 1.5 of the day. In the May contract, 330, the high, the low at 325.5, settlement price at 328.5, up 1.75 for the day. In July, that's your harvest month, 331.5 high, low at 327. July wheat for next year, 331.25, the settlement price up 2.5 cents. Corn futures were off today, 207.25 in the December contract was the high, the low at 203, a settlement price at 204.25 in what most traders considered lackluster trading for the day. The March futures, 217.25 the high, low at 213.25, settled at 214.5. Pushed higher and then finished lower, down 1.25 for the day. The May contract, 225, the high, the low at 220.75, settled 221.5, and they were down 1.5 cents. July contract, down 0.75 cents, 231.5, the high, the low at 227, a settlement price at 228.75, down 0.75 cents, and the September, 236.5, the high, the low at 234.5, settlement price at 235, and that was unchanged for the day. December for next year in the corn pit, 244.75, the high, low at 243, settlement price at 244, and they were down 0.25 cents at the end of the day. December oats, 144.75, high, low at 141.5, settlement price at 143.75, unchanged on the day. In the March contract, a 151.75 high, low at 149, settled 150.5 unchanged. From the soy complex now, the nearby November beans, 516.5 the high, the low at 509.5, a settlement price there up 6 cents today at 515.5. They followed the bean oil up, as that was really the only thing that was in the market for the day, according to the trade, the NOPA, that's the National Oilseed Processors Association, coming out with a number this morning that was fairly bullish for the bean oil products, and we'll talk about that in a minute. January beans now 522, the high, the low at 516.5, settlement price at 521.25. They were up 4 cents in the March contract, a 528 high, Law at 523, March soybeans settled 527 and three quarters, up 4.5 for the day. May futures 535 high, low at 530 and 1/2, settled 533 and three quarters. They were up 3 cents on the day. In July contract, 541.5 the high, low at 537.5, settlement price at 539 and three quarters, up 2 cents. The August futures up 2 as well, 542 the high, the low, and the settlement price there for the August soybeans. October bean meal, 152.50 the high, the low at 149, settled 152.50 a short ton, up 130. And the December bean meal, 153.50 the high, the low at 152.10, settled 152.50, and they were off 40 cents for the day. October bean oil now, 2024 the high, the low at $20.06 a pound, settlement price at 20.20, and they were up 30. And the October oil, 2050, or rather December oil, 2057, the high, the low at 2007, settled $20.50, up 45 cents for the day. Here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. October feeder cattle, 114.30, the high, 113.55, the low, 114.12.5, the settlement, that up 2.5. November, 112.75, the high, 111.75, the low, 112.20, the settlement, that down 22.5. January, 109.65, the high, 108.45, the low, the settlement, 108.85, down 65. October live cattle, 86.60, the high, 85.75, the low, 86.25, the settlement, that up 20. December, 88.60, the high, 87.65, the low, 88.10, the settlement, that down 25. October lean hogs, 72.12.5, the high, the low, 71.70, the settlement, 71.95, unchanged. December, 65.25, the high, 64.30, the low, 64.85, the settlement, that up 17.5. February, 65.25, the high, 64.30, the low, finishing at 64.87.5, that up 20 cents. April lean hogs, 63.10, the high, 62.25, the low, 62.85, the settlement, that up 15. And February bellies, 94.30, the high, 93.35, the low, 93.60, the settlement, that down 70. The Dow is down 96 points, the NASDAQ off 15, and the S&P 500 9 lower.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Anderson Foundation, AgriFab Incorporated, Sullivan, Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Rich Tuohy from Seattle, Washington writes, "Dear Dr. Science, chickens? I don't have any questions about chickens. Do other people have questions about chickens? I'd like to hear those questions."
Well, I checked our chicken file, and discounting the ones about chickens crossing the road and the ever-frequent McNugget question, we get precious few questions concerning chickens. Now, turkeys are much more popular, as are hamsters, guinea pigs, and lab rats.